Hi, this is Jawbone. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He stands about 5'11", weighs 160 pounds, so he does not have a weight problem. But he has been thinking about our collective weight problem, but not thinking about it in a way that most people think about it. In fact, not even close.
What we've learned over time, which is one of the most surprising things about obesity, is that the body has a very strong homeostasis device, which makes it both hard to gain weight and hard to lose weight. So the calculation I did was a simple one. I eat probably 2,800 calories a day, and I like eating. So let's just say I decided I wanted to go up to 3,300 calories a day, an extra 500 calories a day. I want to do that for the rest of my life. Now, you might think, well, if you did that, that my weight would essentially go to infinity, that extra 500 calories would pile up and pile up and pile up. And the rough rule of thumb people use is that every maybe 3,500 calories turns into a pound. And so you would think, you know, my God, you're going to gain a pound a week for the rest of your life. It turns out I wouldn't, that because of the way the body works, I would only gain 40 pounds. So if I started this when I was a little younger, when I was 20, then I could have basically, instead of being 160 pounds my whole life, I could have been 200 pounds my whole life, and I could have had an extra 8.7 million calories over the course of my life. Now, the experts agree that if I weighed 200 pounds instead of 160 at my height, it might cost me a year or two of life expectancy. And when you do all the multiplication and the value of life calculations, it turns out that roughly every extra 1,000 calories I consume shorten my life enough that I would pay about a dollar. And that's the price. So it turns out that every extra Coke that I drink is about 15 cents in shortened life.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, things you did not know about obesity and what to do about it.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
On today's episode, we are talking about obesity. Now, obesity is a problem that is at once terrible and wonderful. Wonderful because it represents our ability to produce delicious, safe, affordable food for billions of people, something that not so long ago doomsayers were saying was not possible. And it's a terrible problem because, well, collectively, we eat too much of that delicious, affordable food, much of which, in fact, is not at all good for us. Chris Economos, who studies obesity and childhood nutrition at Tufts University, says that more than one in three children and adolescents in the U.S. are overweight or obese.
The obesity rates for children have tripled in the United States over the last 40 years, and there are dramatic health and societal consequences that result from that. Some are immediate and some are long-term, particularly because childhood obesity leads to adult obesity.
And persuade me one step further that adult obesity, in addition to being uncomfortable and, unappealing for a lot of people for a lot of reasons, talk about the actual dangers of that in terms of morbidity, mortality, social costs, so on.
Sure. 66% of adults in the U.S. are overweight and obese, and the health consequences are enormous, and they include the development of type 2 diabetes, orthopedic problems, cardiovascular disease, a shorter lifespan, lost productivity, and there are serious social consequences as well. There's isolation, mental health issues that develop as a result of first minor and then major depression. So it really is catastrophic when you put it together.
Catastrophic and expensive, too. Obesity-related health care makes up roughly 20% of our total health care spending, which, in turn, represents nearly 20% of our GDP. So there are all kinds of reasons, financial, political, moral reasons, to address obesity. And there are all kinds of ideas, too. Today, we wanted to bring you some different ideas. Steve Levitt, whom you heard from earlier, tends to have a lot of different ideas. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. He also started a consulting firm called The Greatest Good, which takes on regular consulting business, but also, once in a while, gets hired by a philanthropist or a foundation to tackle a problem like obesity. That's what happened recently. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, whose mission is to, quote, improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, asked The Greatest Good to put together a one-day think tank on childhood obesity. So we gathered up about a dozen people, nutrition experts and academics, some other interested folks, for a brainstorm. We should say here that the viewpoints that you'll hear do not necessarily reflect the opinion of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Mary Story. I'm at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota.
I'm Daniel Kahneman. I'm a psychologist. I know essentially nothing about this particular topic.
I'm Peter Attia. I'm a co-founder and run a nonprofit organization in San Diego called Nutrition Science Initiative.
I'm Jim Marks. I'm Senior Vice President at the Foundation.
Steve Gortmaker. I'm at Harvard School of Public Health.
Great. Jeff Canada at Harlem Children's Zone.
Brian Mullaney, co-founder of Smile Train.
And I'm Kelly Brownell from Yale, and I run a place called the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity.
Good morning. I'm Chris Economos. I'm at the Friedman School of Nutrition at Tufts University.
I'm Eric Oliver. I'm a political scientist at the University of Chicago. I guess I'm here as a skeptic.
I'm Bill Dietz. Until June, I was the director of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at the Centers for Disease Control, and now I'm an active citizen.
I'm David Laveson from Harvard. I'm a behavioral economist. My specialty is self-regulation and behavior change, getting people to save more.
We met down in Princeton at the Foundation's headquarters. I moderated the discussion. The only rule was that no idea was off limits, no matter how absurd or politically incorrect or repugnant it might seem. This podcast is meant to give you a seat at the table. We begin with a question that Steve Levitt asked the group. The answer, as you'll hear, shows just how insidious the obesity problem is.
Is there anyone in this room who thinks that under the age of one, we have a problem with nutrition for babies?
Probably.
Yes.
And I would go one step further, Steve. I would say in utero, we have some pretty good evidence to suggest that maternal diabetes, and I don't even mean frank diabetes, I mean hyperglucose, hyperinsulinemia, during the critical period of development of fetal pancreas plays an enormous role in obesity, because there's only, like, I think it's about a six-week window where the fetus pancreas is developing. If that pancreas develops in a high-glucose environment versus a low-glucose environment, it develops more beta cells. So all of a sudden, a child is now born more predisposed. They're not born insulin-resistant, but now they're more predisposed to being insulin-resistant. And then when you look at, you know, I do this, it drives my wife bananas. When I'm in the grocery store, I get so angry. I take photos of baby food. I turn it over and I'm like, interesting that baby formula number one, ingredient number one, high fructose corn syrup, ingredient number two, modified cornstarch, ingredient three, yep, hydrolyzed, and it's like, yep, well, gee, that's interesting.
That was Peter Attia. He used to be a surgeon, now he runs a nonprofit called the Nutrition Science Initiative. His hypothesis is that of all the contributing factors to obesity, by far the greatest may be the prevalence of sugar in the modern diet. Sugar in all its many, many forms. Now, some of these sugars are disguised. A lot of carbohydrates like bread and pasta, for instance, which most people don't think of as sugary at all. And some couldn't be any more obvious, like soda. Over the past few decades, the average American kid doubled his intake of soda. Overall, he eats and drinks about 180 more calories a day, which is at least a 10% increase, although lately the data seem to show that increase has plateaued. Now, most of these extra calories come from snacks. So, say what you will about how kids are less active today than they used to be, how screen time has risen. The fact is that calories drive weight, especially the calories that don't have any nutrition attached to them, which, by the way, tend to be the cheapest calories. So, given all the empty extra calories that kids are consuming, we probably shouldn't be too surprised that a third of them are obese. I'm curious whether anybody knows about children's awareness of obesity as an issue among themselves and how recent that is and how what the magnitude is.
I know a little bit. We just had a paper accepted. It's in press. It was a national survey of children asking them, what do you think about obesity? How aware are you about it? What do you think happens when a child is overweight and obese? And it's all about not fun to be a heavy kid, stigmatized, isolation, bullying, all the things you'd expect. Pretty high awareness. When you stratify by kids who self-classify as being overweight, they worry about everything more, not only being overweight, but their grades, getting in a car accident, not having money around.
Yeah, and the way this plays out is that kids, even at a small degree of overweight or a body that doesn't look like everybody else's, are the subject of incredible teasing and bullying.
Yes.
I mean, the heartbreaking stories are just amazing. So I think Steve's right. I think all of these things are a significant cost to society and to the individuals as well. And I would perceive it as two lines that cross, that in childhood the social costs are way higher than the medical cost. Then that changes over time, and then the medical costs would go in the opposite direction, that they would be less significant in childhood and greater as age grows older, so these lines would cross. Now, it doesn't mean that the stigma is not important to adults. The wage penalties, marriage penalties, all these sort of things are very significant to people. But as a child, it's especially extreme.
Now, can I add just a twist to that, which is I think kids are very, very aware of weight, obesity, and there's all of that social stigma. But what I think they don't perhaps have the sophistication of a 35-year-old adult is an understanding the mapping from what they're eating to how over the next 4 or 5 years they're going to become obese and how their exercise also maps into that. And so even if they think obesity is terrible, I don't want to be heavy, my peers who are obese are getting teased, they still need to understand how millions of actions translate into that outcome. And that is subtle, and I think it's particularly problematic because of the delay between the action and the outcome. We know that organisms learn, humans, other animals learn really well when you do something and instantly you get feedback that's clear. And learn terribly when, you know, we can talk about lots of animal studies where if the feedback comes 4 minutes later, the animal never learns.
Well, David, can I push you on that question? Because one thing that you said that struck me is that you said that children need to be able, I think that children need to be able to sort of see the consequences of their behaviors. And then the way a 35-year-old adult could. And I think part of the difficulty with obesity, at least as it's been framed, is that 35-year-olds don't do a very good job. Relative to sort of their own sort of decision-making framework. So I'm wondering if that's even a reasonable standard to hold up with respect to kids in terms of their own capacity for, you know, making decisions that we might want them to make.
I completely endorse that. It's hard for a 35-year-old adult, and it's worse for the 8-year-old kid.
Okay. I just want to reinforce David's implied point. I saw the meeting in terms of behavioral change as how do you change parental behavior?
Yeah.
Changing child behavior, forget it. Parental behavior is going to be very difficult.
I just wanted to insert something just a little bit different to think about. I just finished a study on new immigrants, and you know, many of them arrive here from an environment where food is limited, it's highly ritualized, there's no snacking, and you watch them navigate this obesogenic environment in a short amount of time, and you see obesity manifest very quickly. Mm-hmm. And one of the underlying things that we're looking at carefully is time trade-offs and time use, which leads to behaviors that cause obesity. And so as we think about this problem, I'm not an expert on time trade-offs, but there's a whole literature on it, and we're studying it. And I think it's important because it leads people directly to the foods that we're describing and the overconsumption that results. So I don't know how to factor it in, yeah. But I think it's extremely important. And to watch it unfold in a short amount of time is fascinating. It's basically what many of us experience over decades.
That was, in order of appearance, Chris Economos, Kelly Brownell, David Labeson, Eric Oliver, and Daniel Kahneman. Jeffrey Canada runs a nonprofit in New York City called Harlem Children's Zone. In the beginning, it focused on education and drug prevention. But over time, Canada says, obesity became a big deal.
Well, you know, it started out being a small aspect of our work until we realized that about 40% of our kids are obese. It is a huge epidemic in our community. And so while we're preparing kids for college, we want these kids to become productive members of society. You know, one of the things that happens in a place like Harlem is that it's almost like a black hole of taxes. All of the tax dollars come in. We're paying for prisons and jails and reform schools and emergency visits to the hospital and special education services. And so few folk are able to work and work long periods of time that you don't get folks actually contributing back to society. If my kids who are going to college, which they will, all end up getting sick in their 30s and 40s, and their health care costs simply skyrocket. Again, we've not solved that equation. So we felt that it was very much part of our job to not just get these kids in college, but to get them in college healthy so they can come out and have full productive lives, and we can really make sure that they can contribute to society.
Fighting obesity, Jeff Canada told the group, is in some ways harder than fighting drugs or school dropouts.
I mean, we got into this because of the morbidity and mortality issues 10 years ago, just looking at what was happening in Harlem, and you could see the end result of people in wheelchairs, missing legs and feet and stuff like that, and say, you know, this is a horror show, what's causing it, and it all traced backwards to this issue of what's happening with young people. But it's become, I think, for me, a lot more complicated because some of this is, I think, based on what parents and kids do. But I believe a huge percentage of this is based on what commerce does in certain communities. And, you know, I made the statement, and I still believe that I never thought I was going to get rid of drugs in Harlem. I just wanted drugs to be sold in Harlem the way they're sold in the suburbs, right? Quietly, anonymously, that it's not pervasive like this is the way of life and this is the main commerce of this community. I feel the same way about a lot of what's happening in the inner cities. It is almost impossible to get healthy things, and it is very easy to get all of these unhealthy things. And so even as we're thinking about kids and adults and families, I'm worried that as the market has depended on these communities to consume more and more of these unhealthy foods and beverages, we're up against more than just a parental sort of concern because of all of the commercials, the advertising, the accessibility. And so all of that to me suggests that some communities are more vulnerable than others, even if you could sort of deal with lots of the challenges that families and individuals have. So that's one issue. I have become increasingly convinced, and I am no scientist, that a lot of this is addictive behavior, that the sugar that folks consume, it is an instant feedback. Eating a Twinkie. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one that gets that sort of satisfaction from doing it. But lots of families, I think, are using food, right, because the rest of their lives are so horrible that this is something they actually, you know, you can enjoy, and now Jeff wants to take that from you too.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, some palatable and not so palatable ideas to fight childhood obesity.
Imagine a world where I could consume a parasite that could not reproduce, and it would go into my bloodstream, and it would basically make the things that I eat ineffective as nutrients, and they would flush out of my body.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by LegalZoom, providing access to a network of attorneys for legal guidance through their legal plans available in most states. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but has been dedicated to the legal needs of individuals, families, and small businesses for more than 12 years, providing self-help services at user-specific direction. Information about wills, living trusts, incorporations, LLCs, trademarks, and legal plan attorneys at LegalZoom.com. Use the code FREAK for a special offer available to Freakonomics listeners. Freakonomics Radio is supported by GoToMeeting from Citrix, designed to be a fast and simple way to meet and collaborate online to get work done. GoToMeeting allows users to share screens, change presenters, and includes HD Faces video conferencing. GoToMeeting allows clients and coworkers to collaborate face-to-face and stay connected from wherever they are, using any computer or mobile device. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and enter promo code FREAK for a free 30-day trial.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Steve Levitt and I recently spent a half day running a brainstorming session for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on the topic of childhood obesity. One of the only ground rules was that no idea was considered beneath discussion. Did you know, for instance, that quitting smoking, which is plainly good for your health, usually leads to a significant weight gain? So the good news is that the American smoking rate has fallen from 45% in the 1950s to about 24%. But the bad news, well, here's Bill Dietz, the former CDC official.
The estimates are that the reduction in tobacco use accounts for maybe 20% of existing obesity.
Right. So, you know,
Very little in kids.
Okay, so no one is going to push for, say, putting cigarette machines in schools to fight obesity. But we did want to hear any other ideas from our participants, so we started a lightning round. Should we put pressure on?
Yeah.
All right. What do you got?
In grocery stores, unhealthy foods would have to be restricted to certain locations, such as the back of the store.
Oh, like the porno department in the video store idea.
Abolish sucrose and high fructose corn. So don't even forget about taxing them. Just pretend they don't. Take them off the face of the earth.
Okay.
Right now, businesses can write off all the money they spend marketing to kids as a business expense. Just eliminate that tax deduction.
I would say start a real public health campaign aimed at the big food companies, where we should be talking about how many people have been killed by Cokes and Pepsis and whatever, and just make it so that they feel the pressure to reform their practice.
Like a list of shame?
Just a big national shame thing with all the big companies.
We talked about doing that.
You know?
Well, in the spirit of completely impractical things, I would want to get rid of marketing of any product to any human being.
No, I can see that's
like
viable,
that.
Yeah.
No, what I would do is would be to sequester it out there somewhere so people could voluntarily go find it.
But so it's all opt-in marketing.
It's opt-in marketing, and so billboards and TV commercials and stuff would be forbidden, because it just seems to me that marketing does have some benefits, obviously for the companies, but to the individual it has a small number of benefits but a huge number of downsides. Mm. And, of course, food, we get caught up in this in a positive way, but that's what I would do.
Wow. Thanks. Chris?
So I'm going to focus on parenting and the schools. So the first one is to hold our educational system accountable to deliver nutrition, physical activity, and media literacy by requiring standardized tests to assess it. Set a baseline, measure the baseline, set some benchmarks, and move the entire system along and treat it as important as some other things. And the second is to change the home environment by incentivizing parents through health insurance, worksite, or welfare benefits to make a commitment to healthy parenting.
Great. Eric?
I think we need to have a paradigm shift and embrace a paradigm shift and really let go of obesity as a target of health remediation and just focus everything on malnutrition. It seems most of our discussion here is really about childhood nutrition. obesity has a lot of cultural baggage associated with it. I think it's an imprecise marker, even though it's an available marker. With Michelle Obama's campaign, I'm afraid that childhood obesity has become politicized in a partisan way now, and that makes it more difficult kind of issue to focus on. And I just wonder if we would do better by making this an issue of malnutrition.
Let me tweak this. So yeah. I think the word malnutrition actually doesn't work very well because malnutrition implies hunger. But whenever you say like metabolic
syndrome,
no, but you have a bigger one than that. What is it?
Metabolic derangement.
Derangement. Yeah, it seems
to
be.
It's not going to be a bumper sticker, is it?
Well, no, I don't know. But
stop metabolic derangement.
But I like the idea of putting together what you two are both saying, which is that if you could get a fresh start, if you had the right marketing behind the idea that there's a package of horrendous disease states which you're heading towards, and actually the marketing around metabolic syndrome doesn't do it for me. Okay, I like derangement better, although I don't know what I mean. But it seems to me that actually the idea of marketing the concept of there is this one thing which has 100 bad things with it just strikes me as a really interesting way of trying to reframe the argument.
Marrying that to where Chris is going with parenting, which I really applaud because I think parents get off the hook really easy, way too easy, because most kids will eat what they want to eat when it's available, right? And we're the ones that make it available to them. So what about using – I actually like malnutrition because I think – it connotes the fact that, yes, we used to have the problem that people were ill because they didn't get enough to eat. Now, they are still ill because they're just eating too much of the wrong thing. I actually find that paradox appealing, but that's just me personally. But what if you could marry the concept of malnutrition with shaming? What about shaming the parents? What about this is a crusade that parents are really...
Well, that's sexy. If you mailed 100 million homes, is your child suffering from metabolic derangement? They're going to read that. Is your kid fat? Goes right in the
trash. Exactly.
You know?
Right.
Just picking up on this, one of the things we found in our research, and we actually haven't talked about this yet, is when you focus on obesity in kids, you also have a side effect in that you'll increase eating disorders among kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has big cost also. Yeah. We found that by just focusing on healthier eating and physical activity, you can reduce obesity in kids and reduce eating disorders at the same time. So I think I agree with don't focus on fat among kids or obesity as a topic, but focus on the behaviors and the environment you want to change.
Several of the most intriguing ideas in the lightning round came from one person, Harvard economist David Leibs.
I very much like the idea of a tax, and I have a feeling that, you know, to an economist, that's delicious.
Leibson proposed a grand experiment where in some places you'd put a tax on unhealthy foods and in other places leave prices the same to see how consumers would respond and how much it would cost to nudge people away from those cheap, empty calories. Leibson also had an idea for a piece of caloric monitoring jewelry.
Imagine you had a bracelet that a kid wore, or an adult wears, if I had this, it would affect my behavior. And as I go into a meal, it starts registering 200, 700, 900, 1400 calories. And as it tells me I'm eating more and more in this feeding episode, it starts to change its color from green to yellow to orange to red. And then it starts pulsing red, 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 once I get, you know, way out of range.
And then squeezing it tighter and tighter.
There's many aspects of this that may seem effective if the technology could be developed, and we can put that issue of how to develop the implanted probe so that you actually can get this external measurement, though there are increasingly external, you know, diabetic measures that can pick stuff up like this. But the reason I mention this is that it goes back to the reinforcement learning point that I made earlier, which is organisms are very good at learning when the stimulus and response are tightly linked in time. And they're terrible at learning when stimulus and response are separated by, like, 10 minutes, let alone 5 years. So if we could somehow help people realize what you just ate is doing it now, I think people would feel much more negativity towards overeating.
And David Labson's final idea? Let me just say, a few of you might find this a bit distasteful.
Imagine a world where I could have, consume a parasite that could not reproduce, and it would go into my bloodstream, and it would basically make the things that I eat, ineffective as nutrients, and they would flush out of my body. And because the parasite doesn't reproduce, I can control how much I want, and I can find out if I'm, too skinny, I don't take the parasite, and if I'm getting fat, I take the parasite. So what I'm proposing is a world where, hey, we love eating. I love my Reuben sandwich last night, and I could have more of those in principle, up to a limit, if I had an ability to kind of turn off my body's capacity. My body's so efficient at turning calories and nutrients into more of me. And if I partially incapacitated that in a way that we could control, a way that was safe, in a way that, wouldn't it be fantastic? Because then the food companies could sell more food.
Okay. So it's always been my belief that when there's one economist in the room, you feel like you're really smart. And when there are two, you feel really dumb. And so just an example of this. So David talked about his parasite. I spent all afternoon learning about tapeworms yesterday because all economists think exactly alike about these things. And I came to believe that obviously you can do better than the current tapeworm, but there are some pretty good tapeworms out there right now. There's certainly bad tapeworms. There's a fish tapeworm, it turns out, which you wouldn't really want in your body. But as far as I could tell, I think it was the beef tapeworm. I mean, there's all sorts of tapeworms that actually are not perfect, but are pretty good already at doing what David wants them to do. And I'm sure if we could domesticate them with the kind of effort we put into dogs and cows and things, we could make tapeworms are some of the most loyal and serviceable pets that would ever be out there.
That was Steve Levitt, and before him, David Labson. As you can tell, obesity is one of those problems that is so tricky that some of the possible solutions are bound to be outlandish. It's hard to say how or if any of the ideas you heard today will be acted upon. Steve Levitt and I were just the facilitators of this discussion. Other people will be the executors. When it was over, Levitt and I held a brief postmortem. We closed the proceedings with an experiment, something you've dreamed about, that you've talked about for years and years. Why don't you describe that and tell me what effect you think it had?
So one of the issues we didn't talk a whole lot about during this conference was self-control and the fact that many people who want to lose weight are unable to do so because they, in the moment, end up eating more than they would like to and regretting it later. So there are different solutions to that. One very aggressive and invasive solution is bariatric surgery, which makes it difficult for you to eat a lot. But my father really put the idea in my head many years ago when he suggested that if you really don't want to gain weight, whenever you start to think you're hungry, you should carry around a little jar of like a baby food jar that's filled with human vomit and just open it up, take a whiff, and you won't have any desire to do it. Now, turns out it's operationally hard to figure out how to get vomit into a baby food jar. But my friends at www.liquidass.com have actually done that favor for us. So I recently discovered you can buy in a bottle, a little spray bottle or a squeeze bottle, the most revolting smelling things in the world, which all you need to do is take one or two whiffs of them, and you think you don't need to eat for a long time after that. And so we brought it out to show the obesity researchers and to take their pulse on it. So as we passed these bottles around the room and invited people to have a sniff, I noticed that almost all of the outsiders, the economists and the sociologists, political scientists, many of them took a good deep whiff, but none of the obesity experts went anywhere. No, not one of them wanted to take a whiff of that stuff. I think it tells you something.
What does it tell you?
I'm not sure, but I'm going to have to think about it. But the division in response was notable.
And liquid ass. So,
I tell you, see. Great.
Can't we randomly assign this and bring out the impact?
Have a lottery.
I mean, I realize it's kind of jokey, but do you think it's a personal responsibility idea here? In other words, do you think that the experts have come to divorce the idea of obesity and personal responsibility to the point where the problem is not really on the end user so much and they don't need to work so hard?
It is an interesting point you raised, that I do believe that the outsiders were much quicker to think about the problem at the individual level. About self-control, about why do individuals become obese, whereas the experts in the field think of it much more in environmental terms and what are the food companies doing and how are things marketed and how the individual is not really the actor, they're the acted upon. It is an interesting difference.
Dwayne from the foundation, I have to say, he stuck his nose deep in each, and he had, of course, the classic quote. You remember exactly what he said?
Ass and vomit smell different.
He said something like, are really not the same. Up next time on Freakonomics Radio, of all the problems with the U.S. tax system, one of the biggest is also the most obvious. Too many people don't pay what they owe. Now, how much money are we talking about here? At least $450 billion, billion with a B, every year. So, for a minute, forget about wholesale tax reform. What are some good ideas to simply get people to pay up? Here's one imported from England.
So just telling people that 9 out of 10 other people pay their tax on time is enough to create a 15 percentage point increase in the number of people who then just pay their tax.
Using the herd mentality and other nudges to help close the tax gap, that's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Susie Lechtenberg. Our staff includes Catherine Wells, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
The Blues come alive at WHFR's Spring Benefit on Saturday, April 27th, with Motor City Slim, Jeff Malin. Baby, were you there when the deal went down? I said, Motor City Josh. I'll live the blues, no, that ain't no lie. I live the blues, you know that ain't no lie. Well, just a minute and I'll tell you all the reason why. And Big Ray and the Motor City Kings. Just a $5 donation at the door for this great show. 21 and over, please. Join us on Saturday, April 27th at the New Place Lounge in Dearborn for live blues music, support of WHFR, and a real good time.
What is that?
Oh, that? It's my time machine.
Does it work?
Sure. Just hit this button.
Whoa, dinosaurs. Cool.
Or we can go here.
Hey, that's Napoleon.
Oui.
Or we can go to the future.
Wow, hey, you have this nice house. Do I have a nice house?
No, you didn't save any money. Always spent it on vacations and stuff.
If only there was a way I could go back in time and correct that bad habit.
Yep. Okay, the time machine is not real, but the saving thing is. Get in the habit of putting some of your money in savings each week through a 401k, savings account, or financial investments. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy tips on saving, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org.
What does this crazy little button do?
No! This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
I want to talk a little bit today about labor and work. When we think about how people work, the naive intuition we have is that people are like rats in a maze. That all people care about is money. And the moment we give people money, we can direct them to work one way, we can direct them to work another way. This is why we give bonuses to bankers and pay in all kinds of ways. And we really have this incredibly simplistic view of why people work and what the labor market looks like. At the same time, if you think about it, there's all kinds of strange behaviors in the world around us. Think about something like mountaineering and mountain climbing. If you read books of people who climb mountains, difficult mountains, do you think that those books are full of moments of joy and happiness? No, they're full of misery. In fact, it's all about frostbites and difficulty to walk and difficulty of breathing, cold, challenging circumstances. And if people were just trying to be happy, the moment they would get to the top, they would say, "This was a terrible mistake, I'll never do it again." Instead, let me sit on a beach somewhere drinking mojitos. But instead, people go down, and after they recover, they go up again. And if you think about mountain climbing as an example, it suggests all kinds of things. It suggests that we care about reaching the end, a peak. It suggests that we care about the fight, about the challenge. It suggests that there's all kinds of other things that motivate us to work or behave in all kinds of ways. And for me personally, I started thinking about this after a student came to visit me. This was a student that was one of my students a few years earlier, and he came one day back to campus, and he told me the following story. He said that for more than 2 weeks, he was working on a PowerPoint presentation. He was working in a big bank, and this was in preparation for a merger and acquisition. And he was working very hard on this presentation. Graphs, tables, information. He stayed late at night every day. And the day before it was due, he sent his PowerPoint presentation to his boss. And his boss wrote him back and said, "Nice presentation, but the merger is canceled." And the guy was deeply depressed. Now, at the moment when he was working, he was actually quite happy. Every night he was enjoying his work, he was staying late, he was perfecting this PowerPoint presentation. But knowing that nobody would ever watch that made him quite depressed. So I started thinking about how do we experiment with this idea of the fruits of our labor. And to start with, we created a little experiment in which we gave people Legos and we asked them to build Legos. And for some people, We gave them a Lego and we said, hey, would you like to build this Bionicle for $3? We'll pay you $3 for it. And people said yes, and they built this Lego. And when they finished, we took it, we put it under the table, and we said, would you like to build another one? This time for $270. If they said yes, we gave them another one. And when they finished, we asked them, do you want to build another one for $240, $210, and so on, until at some point people said, no more. It's not worth it for me. This was what we called the meaningful condition. People build one Bionicle after another. After they finished every one of them, we put them under the table, and we told them that at the end of the experiment, we will take all these Bionicles, we will unassemble them, we will put them back in the boxes, and we will use it for the next participant. There was another condition. This other condition was inspired by David, my student. And this other condition we called the Sisyphic condition. And if you remember the story about Sisyphus, Sisyphus was punished by the gods to push the same rock up a hill. And when he almost got to the end, the rock will roll over and he would have to start again. And you can think about this as the essence of doing futile work. You can imagine that if he pushed the rock on different hills, at least he would have some sense of progress. Also, if you look at prison movies, sometimes the way that the guards torture the prisoners is to get them to dig a hole, and when the prisoners finish, they ask them to fill the hole back up and then dig again. There's something about this cyclical version of doing something over and over and over that seems to be particularly demotivating. So in the second condition of this experiment, that's exactly what we did. We asked people, would you like to build one Bionicle for $3? And if they said yes, they build it. And then we asked them, do you want to build another one for $270? And if they said yes, we gave them a new one. And as they were building it, we took apart the one that they just finished. And when they finished that, we said, would you like to build another one? This time for 30 cents less. And if they said yes, we gave them the one that they built and we broke. So this was an endless cycle of them building and we destroying in front of their eyes. Now what happens when you compare these two conditions? The first thing that happened was that people build many more Bionicles. They build 11 versus 7 in the meaningful condition versus the Sisyphus condition. And by the way, we should point out that this was not big meaning. People were not curing cancer or building bridges. People were building Bionicles for a few cents. And not only that, everybody knew that the Bionicles would be destroyed sooner, quite soon, right? So there was not a real opportunity for big meaning, but even the small meaning made a difference. Now, we had another version of this experiment. In this other version of the experiment, we didn't put people in this situation. We just described to them the situation, much I'm describing to you now, and we asked them to predict what the result would be. What happened? People predicted the right direction, but not the right magnitude. People who were just given the description of the experiment said that in the meaningful condition, people would probably build one more Bionicle. So people understand that meaning is important, they just don't understand the magnitude of the importance, the extent to which it's important. There was one other piece of data we looked at. If you think about it, there are some people who love Legos and some people who don't. And you would speculate that the people who love Lego will build more Legos even for less money, because after all, they get more internal joy from it. And the people who love Legos less will build less Legos because the enjoyment that they derive from it is lower. And that's actually what we found in a meaningful condition. There was a very nice correlation between love of Lego and the amount of Legos people built. What happened in the Sisyphic condition? In that condition, the correlation was zero. There was no relationship between the love of Lego and how much people built, which suggests to me that with this manipulation of breaking things in front of people's eyes, we basically crushed any joy that they could get out of this activity. We basically eliminated that. Soon after I finished running this experiment, I went to talk to a big software company in Seattle. Can't tell you who they were, but they were a big company in Seattle. And this was a group within this software company that was put in a different building, and they asked them to innovate and create the next big product for this company. And a week before I showed up, the CEO of this big software company went to that group, 200 engineers, and canceled the project. And I stood there in front of 200 of the most depressed people I've ever talked to. And I described to them some of these Lego experiments, and they said they have felt like they have just been through this experiment. And I asked them, I said, how many of you now show to work later than you used to? And everybody raised their hand. I said, how many of you now go home earlier than you used to? And everybody raised their hand. I asked them, how many of you now add not so kosher thing to your expense reports? And they didn't really raise their hand, but they took me out to dinner and showed me what they could do with expense reports. And then I asked them, I said, what could the CEO have done to make you not as depressed? And they came up with all kinds of ideas. They said the CEO could have asked them to present to the whole company about their journey over the last 2 years and why they decided to do. He could have asked them to think about which aspect of their technology could fit with other parts of the organization. He could have asked them to build some prototypes, some next generation prototype, and see how they would work. But the thing is that any one of those would require some effort and motivation. And I think the CEO basically did not understand the importance of meaning. If the CEO, just like our participants, thought that the essence of meaning is unimportant, then he would care. And he would tell, well, the moment I directed you in this way, and now I'm starting directing you in this way, everything would be okay. But if you understood how important meaning is, then you would figure out that it's actually important to spend some time, energy, and effort in getting people to care more about what they're doing. The next experiment was slightly different. We took a sheet of paper with random letters, and we asked people to find pairs of letters that were identical next to each other. That was the task. And people did the first sheet, and then we asked them if they want to do the next sheet for a little bit less money, and the next sheet for a little bit less money, and so on and so forth. And we had three conditions. In the first condition, people wrote their name on the sheet, found all the pairs of letters, gave it to the experimenter. The experimenter would look at it, scan it from top to bottom, say, uh-huh, and put it on the pile next to them. In the second condition, people did not write their name on it. The experiment looked at it, took the sheet of paper, did not look at it, did not scan it, and simply put it on a pile of pages, right? So you take a piece, you just put it on the side. In the third condition, the experimenter got the sheet of paper and directly put it into a shredder. What happened in those three conditions? In this plot, I'm showing you at what pay rate people stopped. So low numbers means that people worked harder. They worked for much longer. In the acknowledge condition, people worked all the way down to 15 cents. At 15 cents per page, they basically stopped this effort. In the shredder condition, it was twice as much, 30 cents per sheet. And this is basically the results we had before. You shred people's effort, output, you get them not to be as happy with what they're doing. But I should point, by the way, that in the shredder condition, people could have cheated. They could have done not so good work because they realized that people were just shredding it. So maybe the first sheet you would do a good work, but then you see nobody is really testing it, so you would do more and more and more. So in fact, in the shredder condition, people could have submitted more work and get more money and put less effort into it. But what about the ignored condition? Would the ignored condition be more like the acknowledge or more like the shredder or somewhere in the middle? It turns out it was almost like the shredder. Now, there's good news and bad news here. The bad news is that ignoring the performance of people is almost as bad as shredding their effort in front of their eyes. Ignoring gets you a whole way out there. The good news is that by simply looking at something that somebody has done, scanning it and saying, uh-huh, that seems to be quite sufficient to dramatically improve people's motivations. So the good news is that adding motivation doesn't seem to be so difficult. The bad news is that eliminating motivation seems to be incredibly easy, and if we don't think about it carefully, we might overdo it. So this is all in terms of kind of negative motivation or eliminating negative motivation. The next part, I want to show you something about the positive motivation. So there is a store in the U.S. called the IKEA. And IKEA is a store with kind of okay furniture that takes a long time to assemble. And I don't know about you, but every time I assemble one of those, it takes me much longer, it's much more effortful, it's much more confusing, I put things in the wrong way. I can't say I enjoy those pieces. I can't say I enjoy the process. But when I finish it, I seem to like those IKEA pieces of furniture more than I like other ones. And there's an old story about cake mixes. So when they started cake mixes in the 40s, they would take this powder and they would put it in a box and they would ask housewives to basically pour it in, stir some water in it, mix it, put it in the oven, and voila, you had cake. But it turns out they were very unpopular. People did not want them. And they thought about all kinds of reasons for that. Maybe the taste was not good. No, the taste was great. What they figured out was that there was not enough effort involved. It was so easy that nobody could serve cake to their guest and say, here is my cake. No, 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 it was somebody else's cake. It's as if you bought it in the store. It didn't really feel like your own. So what did they do? They took the eggs and the milk out of the powder. Now, you had to break the eggs and add them. You had to measure the milk and add it, mixing it. Now it was your cake. Now everything was fine. Now, I think a little bit like the IKEA effect, by getting people to work harder, they actually got them to love what they're doing to a higher degree. So how do we look at this question experimentally? We asked people to build some origami. We gave them instructions to how to create origami, and we gave them a sheet of paper. And these were all novices, and they built something that was really quite ugly. Nothing like a frog or a crane. But then we told them, we said, look, this origami really belongs to us. You worked for us, but I'll tell you what, we'll sell it to you. How much do you want to pay for it? And we measured how much they were willing to pay for it. And we had two types of people. We had the people who built it, and we had the people who did not build it and just looked at it as external observers. And what we found was that the builders thought that these were beautiful pieces of origami, and they were willing to pay for them five times more than the people who just evaluated them externally. Now, you could say, if you were a builder, do you think that, oh, I love this origami, but I know that nobody else would love it? Or do you think, I love this origami, and everybody else would love it as well? Which one of those two is correct? Turns out the builders not only loved the origami more, they thought that everybody will see the world in their view. They thought everybody else would love it more as well. In the next version, we tried to do the IKEA effect. We tried to make it more difficult. So for some people, we gave the same task. For some people, we made it harder by hiding the instructions. At the top of the sheet, we had little diagrams of how do you fold origami. For some people, we just eliminated that. So now this was tougher. What happened? Well, in an objective way, the origami now was uglier, was more difficult. Now, when we looked at the easy origami, we saw the same thing. Builder loved it more, evaluators loved it less. When you looked at the hard instructions, the effect was larger. Why? Because now the builders loved it even more. They put all this extra effort into it, and evaluators, they loved it even less, because in reality it was even uglier than the first version. Of course, this tells you about something about how we evaluate things. Now think about kids. Imagine I asked you, how much would you sell your kids for? Right? Your memories and association and so on. Most people would say for a lot of money. On good days. But imagine this was slightly different. Imagine you did not have your kids, and one day you went to the park and you played, you met some kids, and they were just like your kids, and you played with them for a few hours. And when you were about to leave, the parents said, hey, babe, by the way, just before you leave, if you're interested, they're for sale. How much would you pay for them now? Most people say not that much. No? And this is because our kids are so valuable, not just because of who they are, but because of us, because they're so connected to us and because of the time and connection. And by the way, if you think that IKEA instructions are not good, think about the instructions that come with kids. Those are really tough. By the way, these are my kids, which of course are wonderful and so on, which comes to tell you one more thing, which is much like our builders, when they look at the creature of their creation, we don't see that other people don't see things our way. Let me say one last comment. If you think about Adam Smith versus Karl Marx, Adam Smith had a very important notion of efficiency. He gave an example of a pin factory. He said pins have 12 different steps. And if one person does all 12 steps, production is very low. But if you get one person to do step one and one person to do step two and step three and so on, production can increase tremendously. And indeed, this is a great example and the reason for the Industrial Revolution and the efficiency. Karl Marx, on the other hand, said that the alienation of labor is incredibly important and how people think about the connection to what they're doing. And if you make all 12 steps, you care about the pin. But if you make one step every time, maybe you don't care as much. And I think that in the Industrial Revolution, Adam Smith was more correct than Karl Marx. But the reality that we've switched, and now we're in the knowledge economy. And you can ask yourself, what happens in the knowledge economy? Is efficiency still more important than meaning? I think the answer is no. I think that as we move to situation in which people have to decide on their own about how much effort, attention, caring, how connected they feel to it, are they thinking about labor on the way to work and in the shower and so on, all of a sudden, Mark has more things to say to us. So when we think about labor, we usually think about motivation and payment as the same thing. But the reality is that we should probably add all kinds of things to it. Meaning, creation, challenges, ownership, identity, pride, etc. And the good news is that if we added all of those components and thought about them, how do we create our own meaning, pride, motivation, and how do we do it in our workplace and for the employees, I think we could get people to both be more productive and happier. And thank you very much.
WHFR Dearborn.
Welcome to WHFR. I am the Diva, and I would love for you to allow me to add a little heat to your Monday nights. Please join me for Lyrical Infusion every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m., where I blend the lyrics with the melodies to create magical moments of music just for you. Lyrical Infusion with the Diva, Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m. WHFR 89.3. Streaming live at WHFR.FM 24/7.